Welcome, everybody. Burrows and Burbs, episode 75. Today, we're going to talk about attractiveness, loyalty, and persuasion. We're going to talk about them from the clinical perspective. So I've got my special guest, Dr. David Rees, cardiologist, realtor, and global thought leader. And we're going to ask him from a clinical point of view, some of the science behind attractiveness, loyalty, and persuasiveness. And we've got Scott Hobbs, who is a business leader, leads a third generation leader of Hobbs Inc., MBA, student of persuasiveness his entire life, who's been talking to me about how to be more persuasive every time we get together. So I'm very excited. And of course, my co-host, Roberto Cabrera in New York. And with that, let's begin. Dr. David Rees, tell us more about how you got interested in the subjects of attractiveness, loyalty, and persuasiveness from the point of view of a doctor.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to join this group, and I look forward to adding. So I'm a cardiologist. I was in the founding generation of people inventing stent and angioplasty. I had three patent pursuits. Two became commercial. One became global standard of care. I was a young chap then, and I did not understand the key business concept of never enter any project until the exit strategy is clearly elaborated. So I went about $250,000 into my own pocket, chasing after patent work, going up against Johnson & Johnson and Medtronic and Boston Scientific. So you all know where that wound up. But at least I had a chance to test my mind in its depth and comprehensiveness. So when I went into private practice, I recognized on day one that that was a highly dislocated environment, that there was no chance that intellectual capital would be rewarded or really be sustainable, that that was a financial forum for folks not doing the heavy lift to siphon off their appropriately strategized profit. So doctor, owner, operator of medical real estate seemed to me like a really bad bet. There's a moral, ethical bond, right? People trust you with their lives, you stay the course. So at year 15, I left the operating room, kept my practice open another 17 years pro bono, money out of my pocket to keep the door open, but I went into industry. So I was a national Fortune 500 health benefits consultant. I sat at the table where $1 billion, $1.5 billion annual was being navigated and discussed. My projects involved health plan audits and requests for proposal, multi-vendor integration, et cetera. It was clear to me that 18% of GDP was pretty much going down the drain as one-off transactions with a multitude of non-integrated businesses doing their thing. But the end result was not quality of living. So there was no longitudinality to these one-off events. I should also add, I ran Yale University's Outpatient Cardiac Rehab Center where the transplant patients went to get put back together again. So I recognized that the healthcare system one-offs you into transactional health of short warranty, but that quality of living was a real estate play. So I had two lines of business that were apparent to me. My peers who were practicing generational magical thinking, that owning a medical office building was a way to lifestyle into retirement, not understanding that the constraints on margin were profound. For 12 years, I was a national medical director in utilization review. So the health plans took care of unit cost and unit margin, and the utilization review people took care of volume utilization. Right. The regulator imposed all sorts of additional overhead into medical practice. And before you know it, it's a zero margin business. Right. So go ahead, John.
You come from the point of view of a cardiologist, somebody who is advising people on perhaps the most important decision of their life, the heart surgery, the care of the heart, life and death. And you became a realtor and have been for the last 20 years a realtor, which is also, it seems to me, fraught with emotion, an incredibly emotional decision, no matter how scientific we want to be about buying a house, selling a house, it's fraught with emotion. And so you seem, at the very least, coming from the empathy of a doctor would allow you to have empathy as a realtor. However, everybody on this call, there's a lot of realtors on this call, and we spend a lot of time thinking about our image. And it occurs to me that doctors don't and shouldn't, but realtors feel that we get picked based on our attractiveness. Attractiveness, I think, many of us believe is subjective. I don't think that I'm beautiful, but I think I'm capable of being attractive to clients in the business world. And so I wanted to come back to that as sort of the theme of how do we acquire relationships through attractiveness? How do we keep them through loyalty? And how do we persuade in that process to stay with us, to buy a house, to make a decision? That is, to me, the essence of what we're trying to get here this hour. And I'm going to start with a visual. Last week, somebody said, help me pick a realtor in Santa Barbara. And I did what I think many of our customers do. I went on the internet. And this is what I found. I found this page. I found 12 agents in the Santa Barbara office. This is the actual search I did. And when I found 12 agents, I said, how do I pick one of these agents? And I hate to say it, but they all look alike to me. And maybe that's not fair, but you know what? None of them are 20. So none of them looked inexperienced. None of them looked so different from the rest. They all have, meaning they all have a professional photo. Most of them, or all of them, are smiling and trying to look attractive and relatable. None of them are wearing a t-shirt, right? And so I think that this is just an example of some of the pressure we're under to make choices based on attractiveness. Is that a flawed theory, Dr. David?
I think that we're in the business of making business. That's fair to say. And certainly if you are repulsive, repugnant, right, or sending off toxic vibes, you're not going to make business. So that attractiveness is a default. Your method, and we talked about this a little bit before, in your sort, you, with certainty, as a human being, subjected your sort to your own intrinsic selection bias, right? So you defined in your mind what you thought represented attractiveness to the project, which could be different than the consumer, but to the project, your visual sort renders nothing to you about who's a multi-careerist, who has a PhD in project management, who's done incredible, incredible work solving problems, who's got the deepest supply chain connections, et cetera, et cetera. So physical worldism, and we started to talk about AI and replacement of self, through AI. At the end of the day, our job is much more consultative in this world of procedural automation than it is trying to find the right word. Anybody can complete a process, including a robot. Only you can do that thing that you do, right? Consultatively with depth of insight. So your physical world, two-dimensional, who looks good, right, is irrelevant to competencies. And as we joked about before, you would never do a request for a proposal to a vendor, right, based solely on a headshot.
However, do we not agree? It's the first layer. I went to go get onions for chili and I was looking at them. And the first thing I'm looking at is it look good? And I only pick the ones that look good. Then as I peel back the onion, then I get to see what's in it, right?
That's a mixed metaphor.
Right. But you understand what I'm saying. So the attractiveness, you have to have present yourself professionally for one, because otherwise you're out of the subset. You have to make the subset first, and then you start digging into what's next.
What's their experience?
How many exclusives do they have? What neighborhoods do they specialize in, et cetera?
Yes, but what John, and again, Roberto, you didn't look at your menu to decide whether you needed shallot, whether you needed Spanish onion, whether you needed Vidalia onion, you didn't red onion, et cetera. So John's question is, can surface view be adequately revealing? And what I suggested is it's an exclusory observation. You know who doesn't care and presents themselves like a schlep, right? So you can exclude those people. But amongst the people who do demonstrate attentiveness, right, and style, you don't get to beyond that surface. So John, I would be of the opinion that while you may pick five or six people to dig in further on your research, it would be selection bias entirely to find that one person, call that person and say, I've got a case for you.
I just refute the notion that it doesn't matter. I would say that it shouldn't matter, but attractiveness, unfortunately, does matter. And as a result, all the realtors on this call spend a whole lot of money on photography. And if it didn't matter, we wouldn't spend so much money on it. And I know Scott Hobbs sells, $10 million projects, $100 million projects. And how does somebody evaluate a very complex transaction? They're not even just buying a house from Scott. They're buying a relationship with Scott that could take 18 months or 24 months or 36 months to complete the construction of a $20 million project. And they have to evaluate him. What are the tools we use to evaluate? The first thing I think they do is they check him out on his website and they look at his resume. They look at his past projects. They look at my past projects. They look at my resume. But really, we are limited, as Roberto says, to a cursory examination. And a lot of that is attractiveness dependent.
Certainly, people choose to go with what feels comfortable or familiar or sameness, right? Which was the joke. I wore a bow tie for John and I wore a sweater for Roberto today. So, and I didn't know Scott's fashion particularly, but I've got a slide rule here. So I hope that will suffice.
I copy Roberto. It's easy.
There you go. We are in very serious times in society, in consumer choice, in definitions of quality of living, et cetera. So I think that we're dealing with a consumer that has information liquidity. So you joked and said, well, how do people pick a doctor? So when I started my own practice in 1989, this was an age of information hierarchy. This was the era of doctor, oh yes, doctor, whatever you say, doctor. This was pre-WebMD, if you will, right? So the consumer was entirely dependent and there was a hierarchy there. Today, there's information fluidity, right? So you might pick someone based on what seems to be sameness or familiarity based on picture, All right. And yes, I understand that that's if you're driving your car and somebody calls you and says, I need somebody in Santa Barbara, while you're driving, you can go through thumbnails and say, you know what, this person looks like they're pretty put together. Right. But at the end of the day, vendor sourcing and prediction around a successful process requires really digging in. And at some point, getting to know what that person's all about. So John and I came together through John finding my media. And as a clinician, diagnostician who had been in talent in the Fortune 500 segment, this year I decided that it would be really nice to start to communicate. And I've been thinking about this for a long time and watching how other people communicate. And I was determined to maintain a very high bar. I started to make videos that deal with issues of careerism, right? So John found my content, and I'm honored that he thought of it enough to say, why don't you come on and talk about this? So I would say that those headshots, great, but if you want to, shortcut isn't the right word, but if you want to engage your client, You have to be knowable, if you will. So back in the day when I started, people would send, you know, cases to Dr. Reese, right? And you know, they had a need, and I could suit that need, and I looked competent, and we went for it. If you had a problem medically today, a serious problem, you would talk to your local person, but you'd also be on the Cleveland Clinic's website. Right. And you'd also be on Columbia Presbyterian's website and this one and that one, looking at all the people, but not so much looking at their headshot. Right. Because one guy's got a bow tie and another guy's in scrubs, et cetera, et cetera. You'd be looking at their bio and their publications. Right. And that's even before you meet them and test them against the other guy. So if I had an $80 million overseas person who wanted a townhouse in New York City, right? I know that I can go to Roberto, right? Because not because of his website, but because I've experienced him, right? In these chats, I get his comportment, if you will. If I have somebody who wants mid-century modern anywhere in the country, I know to bring John in consultatively, even if it's out of his district, because this is his passion isn't the right word. Subject matter expertise is probably the right word, right? And similarly, if I had somebody who had 1,000 acres in West Virginia that wanted to build a family compound, right? I know that I could call Scott.
Scott Hobbs, I got a question for you. Would you say, you've been in this business a long time trying to sell very big, complicated, and beautiful houses and your ability to make them. You've advertised for decades in the glossy magazines, and they have been dependent on attractive keyword photos. Is the industry shifting? Are you finding that to be attractive in the glossy magazines and online is sufficient, or is the narrative changing toward video, where you are more at, where it is easier to tell a more complicated story? It sort of underscores Dr. David's point that we're moving away from an attractive bias and more toward an, what do you call it, fluidity of information exchange. So I'll come back to Scott and say, would you say that your spending, your emphasis is changing as a result?
Well, I think a challenge for everybody who's trying to be part of a sale is that most people know most of the things that'll be a pre-qualifier. So very few realtors, I'm sure, show up in their underwear, you know, smoking a cigarette and drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning and saying, I'm in this in order to get the biggest commission ever. I mean, you end up having an attractive photo. They talk about serving the client. They talk about, I've been in the business for however long. And odds are, if you were to read the vast majority of them, they're going to sound a lot the same.
Thank you for giving us that picture, though, of a realtor in his underwear smoking a cigarette. Thanks. That's a good baseline to start with.
It's just not attractive. So they're looking for social proof up front of just trying to go ahead and say that this is somebody that other people have used them. I won't be an idiot if I choose them. This is okay. But one of my quotes that I used when I was doing a presentation for a group of builders was that the Ricky Bobby quote from Talladega Nights, if you ain't first, you're last. And that means, and again, that's of course a silly statement under stuff, but the reality in all of our businesses, if you don't win the business, you might as well have been last. Matter of fact, it would have been better to be last because you would have wasted less time and you could have focused on something else you could have won. Now, I think playing to David's point though, the reality is that if you're a top performer, you're gonna make it to the finals. And if you aren't making it to the finals, don't worry about persuasion. You got a lot of other things you got to work on. You got to become an expert. You got to know your stuff. You got to learn about business. You got to know all these things. But when you make it to the final table, those little differences of understanding persuasion and being able to play at the edges will allow you to better serve your client and to let them know you can better serve the client. And a lot of this is an honesty talk on your own part as to what are you selling in an honest way, because if you're otherwise, you're full of crap and it'll come back to bite you someplace else. So I'm not sure if I fully answered it. Yeah, we don't, for the print media, it exists really in order to create other connections. That's why we end up doing the print media, not necessarily in order, well, certainly not to close a sale, but it's in order to create other connections with people.
Scott, is part of it that your competitors are doing these things so that you have to also, because everything's more competitive. I mean, I'm sure your business has become so much more competitive because there's just other players in the marketplace.
You have to pre-qualify on the fact that, again, if we have a bad website, we aren't showing nice photos. Some of the first things someone's going to do is click on us, and their research is going to say, don't call him. Now, once he calls me, then I can get into another level. So I have to qualify on my website in order to make it so that I can be a player. David is an expert. He puts up the videos. When people want to discuss something, he's shown that other people pay attention to him and listen to him. And that helps with that, again, that social proof and the authority side of things, which I think all of us try to do in order to be out there more than just somebody's going to look at a photo and they're going to say, ooh, I love that sweater. And they're going to end up making the choice. Although I will say one danger is the fact that people claim that they make rational decisions. And the reality is they make emotional decisions and then they fill in the rationality to justify their decision. So the more you try to set things up so at least you're not decided against, or hopefully you're decided for, hopefully the better off things will become, turn out for you.
That emotional intelligence bogey, right? Because it's ultimately not an asset, is part of the consultative rigor, John, that you hope to infer in that headshot. Everyone acts in their own interest as a consumer, whether it's in their own interest or not, right? And you don't know what agenda, right, is being manifest at any point in time. So as vendors, as we all are, reputationally, it is critically important that we get to objective best outcome, not just best outcome, right? Because unless there is an objective basis for measuring that process and what happened with that customer, you can derail at any time, right? And none of us have time to have a project derail, disappoint people, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So I found the real estate career to be as multifactorial, as complex, as rigorous as the medical career. I found the medical career to prepare me to deal with the emotional intelligence, right? And to give me the fortitude to analytically and quantitatively confront qualitative subjectivity. Right. So that is to say, and we started off our pre-conversation, John, I was in the, I went to the dentist today. And he, while I was in the chair, John texted me a scientific article about dentition and favorability as a vendor, right? And it made me laugh because, you know, in the AI world, we're talking about getting precise with facial representation, right? So face as an infant is the first thing that you recognize. And that's there's a two compartments to that. One is that you recognize that it's a face, and then more maturely that you recognize that there are different expressions of the face, right? So the whole headshot is very, very primitive, right? I mean, that goes back to infancy, your ability to, or your involuntary response to a face, right?
The study I found, so I started the day looking up studies on attractiveness, and let me give you a quote. Judgments about, this is the conclusion of a study, judgments about integrity and social and intellectual attractiveness were strongly affected by dental aesthetics. And these effects were more dramatic and consistent for male faces. So what does that tell us? That men especially are judged by whether they have ugly teeth. And we're not just judged on being attractive. People make judgments on me, on my integrity, based on the quality of my teeth. And that is not fair. But that's but you're saying it's involuntary, that you look at somebody with ugly teeth and you're like, yeah, I can't trust that guy. I can't trust him with my heart, and I can't trust him to find me the right house. That is not fair, but that's the truth.
Do you think it's that you don't trust the person, or that you just like, I just can't look at these teeth, so I can't deal with this person?
I'm citing a scientific study that said people make strongly affected evaluations of integrity and intelligence. If he has bad teeth, he must not be intelligent. And that's what I'm trying to point out, that we realtors have, we're selling a lot of what we do off of a website, and then through maybe a Zoom, and we finally get to meet you. Maybe we get to meet you, in the process, then we can start to work on, you know, an interpersonal relationship. But we rely a great deal, especially in the land of Zoom. Roberto, how long did we have a Zoom relationship before I actually met you face to face?
Probably 24 months, right?
2 years of experiencing you only in that room with that background behind you.
Yeah, that's correct.
And I never was able to evaluate your teeth to figure out how intelligent you are.
But so can we talk about, so going back to what the doctor says about, like you said, there was a tremendous similarity between the complexity of the presentation between the medical field and the real estate field. However, you had to feel in that you needed to bring different appearances in some way to them. Because if I'm looking at a broker and I'm interviewing him and I'm looking at him, I also am looking at him saying, how will this person represent me to the public? How do they, if I'm going to you as a cardiologist, not a plastic surgeon, I would probably look at a plastic surgeon differently, saying this person needs to be meticulous in their face and this and that. If I'm going to a cardiologist, I'm like, you need to fix me. I don't care what you look like. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I have to be able to communicate with you, but I would be so much less, I'm so much less affected by your appearance. I would definitely die, go right past the onion, dig deep and get inside before, and not even care.
Yeah, so there are different buckets for that. Certainly, if you are unconscious, on your way out the door, right, you don't care, right? If you've got a major, major problem on your hands with huge morbidity, okay, and a whole family, that subtends to that, you care about the intellectual capital and the delivery, right, and the sincerity a lot, right? So medical competencies are not vanity sourced, right? People want to tell their circle, this guy cared about me. This guy really went the distance with me. I love that guy.
Do they say the same thing about their realtor? He cared about me. He went the distance for me.
I think it's probably different vernacular. It's probably this guy really thread the needle, right? And really his valuation, his market, or marketing plan was spot on. In my clinical world, even more important, that guy helped me not go down a templated, this is what the Joneses did, rabbit hole, and counseled me out of my predisposition and directed me to something else entirely, focused on what their understanding of my quality of life would be, right? So yes, I think that realty has a more aesthetic top layer, right? I think that that's absolutely, it's the nature of the beast. But part of our conversation is I think we all do well in an information fluid world to recognize that's just the beginning. That's the ante at the poker table. You got to have that. And your substance has to be extraordinary such that if anybody biases against you, right, it's their loss, right? And you can feel comfortable saying, you know what? There's so many other people who want me. My time is best spent with those people who can appreciate me, which bridges the point of the conversation is you got to know your value.
It's incredibly subjective what I'm hearing. I cannot believe how subjective this is. So attractiveness is subjective. Loyalty is subjective. And at least with baseball players, I know what their ERA and their batting average is. But when I'm trying to evaluate Roberto as a realtor, I can't even look at his average days on market and say, oh, his days on market, they're pretty low. He must sell houses pretty quick. Or he buys houses for his buyers at 10% under ask. You know, his statistics are great. I have to say that what I'm hearing is that how we choose a realtor is incredibly subjective, and how we evaluate them after the fact is incredibly fraught with emotional and bias and subjectivity. And I hate that. This is 2023, people. I hate that. I want some science. Give me some science.
What you're headed towards is codification, right, of the many, many different parameters that go into judging you. So, for example, it was an honor, right, to be invited. So I brought you flowers. Nobody's going to forget that.
That is true.
The guy seeks joy, right? And he's attentive to detail, right? And he understands that everything is about the give.
Again, very subjective. Nobody's been able to measure for me what the effectiveness of flowers and gifts are for a realtor to do it or not do it. It's effective, not very effective. There's no measurement. And I don't know whether you bring in flowers today matters.
All data is good data, whether it's good data or bad data. So you're asking to make an objective scoring. All you can make is a comparative scoring when you ask the consumer, did anybody else bring flowers to the conference?
Fair.
Okay, so
can we step this to the next stage of this, which is loyalty? Because you have a new client. Where are you building loyalty? Loyalty seems to come after you. It's almost after the fact. A repeat customer. Where are you looking? Like, Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. You want me to jump in?
Yes.
I want you to jump in and talk to me about all the ones I'm losing. Everybody on this call has lost a listing recently and said, I can't believe that my relationship, my customer went somewhere else. And I don't understand it because I did everything right. Aren't they loyal? So do we have a flawed sense of loyalty?
Well, John, is it bad to lose every client?
We don't like to lose at all. We like it to be our idea. I want it to be my idea if I lose a client. I don't like it to be their idea. And I hate to admit it to all of you, but sometimes I do lose.
I'll tell you a funny story. It's day one of medical practice, right? Day one, right? I was a fellow the day before. Now I'm an attending physician. And I go to the intensive care unit and sit at the station there, you know, with the charts. And I sit down next to a remarkably elder gentleman, a wisp of a guy. He had to be in his 90s. And he says to me, "You new here?" You know, he was of Italian descent, you know, and he was in his 90s. He says, "You new here?" I said, "Yeah, it's my first day." He says, "Let me do you a favor." I say, "Please." He said, "So I'll teach you." He says, "Come to see me, do me one favor. Don't come to see me, do me two favor." And by that, he meant he only wanted to deal with people who wanted to deal with him. In medical practice, if you lost a patient, it was like catastrophic that they left you after you put your whole heart, you know, and everything into it. Now, yes, pre-HMO, that's definitely true, right? But loyalty is an appropriate self-interest bi-directional loop. It's got to be good for you, and it's got to be good for the customer. And within that subjectivity, if they think that something else is better for them, God bless, right? You should never, ever, ever feel that if somebody left you for whatever reasons, that's their black box, right? And there's nothing that you can do to revert. You know, I mean, back in the day, you'd write a letter to the patient. It's been such a pleasure, you know, working with you, you know, these past 20 years of which you woke me up in the middle of the night every night, you know, for 20 years. Vendoring is like that. And sometimes you get too close and people can't deal with the intimacy.
Sometimes, in your videos, you talk about the bad aspects of loyalty clouding objective decision making, because I've been using this. I've had this relationship with my realtor for a very long time. I'm loyal to her. I'm going to stick with her, even though she's only part-time. He's only part-time now. He's not really working. He spends half his time not in Connecticut anymore, but I'm loyal. So I've got to stick with him. You suggested in your videos that that's a problem toward making the best possible decision.
Yeah. So, you know, the toxic loyalty thing is most apparent when people stay at a brokerage too long after the resources have winnowed, or the individualized attention has gone away, or the focus on the agent's career development sincerely is not present anymore. And, I've been here. This has been my broker. I'm staying. Right. So that's one of the uglies.
By the way, any of you feel that way? We're hiring. Come on down. It's all nice right here. Now go ahead, Dr. David.
Right. The rules of autonomy, if you will, and the rules of integrity dictate that if somebody fires you, that's their decision. You endorse that decision. And you wish them the very, very best. You be a mensch, if you will, and you don't try to wheedle in it. The correct mindset is great. That much more energy for me to dedicate to that many more things, right? It's been great, because once somebody portends to leave you, in medicine, you never let anybody back. right? That's just a setup for a mess. And again, in medicine, you have, you know, med mal issues to deal with, right? So once somebody's gone, they're gone, right? Right. So you quoted Talladega Nights, right? So I'll quote Pulp Fiction, right? When the Ving Rhames character, you know, says you've lost your LA privileges, you're gone, now be gone. Right. It's competitive business. There's a shortage of deals to be done, and it hurts when you lose somebody. That's definitely true. But your own integrity mandates that you stand tall and not doubt yourself, not beat yourself up, and rededicate to all the wonderful people who do want you.
Let's move on to persuasion, because I think it's probably my favorite of the three, and I know it is for Scott. Okay. Is it possible to become a better persuader? And what can we on the call do to become better persuaders? Scott is always telling me that there's a science behind it, that if I would just listen to these podcasts and read these books, I would be a more effective realtor because I would be so much more persuasive. And I take that to mean that there is some science that I could figure out what the magic bullet is. And when my client says, I don't know really what to do about this house. I mean, I kind of like it, but I don't know if I'm paying too much and I don't know if this is the right one. And maybe there's another one to come in next week, that I should be able to say, this is the right answer and persuade them of the right answer. If only I knew the technique. So where's the flaw in that thinking? Is there a magic technique? And I just don't know it.
Overwhelming competency, overwhelming information, overwhelming insight.
A lot of the people on this call have overwhelming insight, and we are just not sufficiently persuasive, Dr. David.
That was from a use case perspective, right? And Scott, you know, that's a phraseology that, you know, is very comfortable. That's an outcome that's not meant to be. So
I don't accept that. I don't accept that at all.
I think you can improve. I think persuasion is an arc. It's a long, and it encompasses the first two pieces because it starts at the beginning when you're planting seeds. It's like baking a cake. You bake a cake over a long period of time at a certain temperature, and then you get to the point and it's complete and you've led your client all the way and you know where you're going. You know the trajectory of where you need to go, and you know where to drop that information along the way, not just at the end and say, here, I got a bucket of stuff. Let me just tell you about all the information that I've got right here. It's a growing process that takes time, because if you take that cake and at the end, all of a sudden you turn up the temperature, you're going to burn it.
Well, let's get clinical. Okay. So we go through this process and we're at the finish line and the person starts to recant. And they start to go through their ambivalence dance, right? And they're finding all sorts of micro variables. You know what? That electrical socket that's over there, it's really disrupting my feng shui. I don't know if I can buy this house, right? And other stuff. If the relationship allows, not to be confrontational, but it is fair game consultatively to say, you know what? I'm picking up on some sidetracking here. Can we dig in and find out what's really going on? Why is this not now suitable, whereas it has been the entire way? What's really going on? And there's always something on the subjective, emotional, personal side of things. And that's where it starts to sort itself out from a real estate agent vendoring perspective is, do you have the credibility? Do you have the currency in the relationship to not confront, but to get clinical and say, listen, what's really going on? Because this is not objective, right?
Many times they say, no, it's like I just told you, it's about the light switch. I recently showed, not so recent, but so case study, we showed 30 houses, everything in the market, to somebody with whom I had had an on and off relationship for decades. I've known them for decades, and they came back in and they said, I want to buy a house. We looked at 30. They made an offer. It was accepted. We went through inspections. It was all the way to the finish line. We're supposed to be done. And they said, if I don't get a credit for all these windows, I want all the windows replaced, then I'm out of here. Now, you're right. I guess I could have said, what's really going on here? I didn't. I don't feel, even after knowing this person for a very long time, that I was allowed to do that, whether I was allowed to question as part of the art of persuasion. But I honestly felt that this was the right house for him based on everything he had told me and everything we had seen, and that it was getting it for the best possible deal. What did I do wrong? If I back off,
well,
I'm not a good realtor. I'm not being the best possible realtor. I need to tell him how I feel. How can I persuade him to move forward when he's giving me a garbage objection?
So is this somebody who always hijacks a deal at, coming down the stretch and always has to have some adolescent moment?
I don't know. We haven't. We don't. Most of us on the call don't have enough history with somebody to witness them hijack many deals.
Okay.
Don't know.
All right. So do I have the license to make a statement like what's really going on? That's a matter of setting rules at the beginning of the project or the beginning of the relationship. That's forecastable. That
okay.
Coming down the stretch, it gets very intense with all sorts of crosstalk, if you will. It's my professional manner that if something that has been green light, green light, green light, red light, I must supportively challenge you in your own best interest to try to discover scoring and objectively what's really going on. Please expect that that's going to be the case.
How is that persuasive?
What's that?
Scott Hobbs, how is that persuasive clinically?
So, John, actually, let me take a slightly different track here. So this sort of situation bothers you, am I hearing you correctly? And you'd like to avoid this in the future. Is that right?
Yes.
So is it possible then that you're willing to actually do some extra work to try to avoid this in the future?
Yes.
So will you finally read Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, and his other book, Persuasion? Because clearly I've been ineffective in trying to tell you that there's stuff out there that you don't have to beat your head against the wall the same way over and over again if you go ahead and pursue some of these things that people
tell us the answer. You have not persuaded me to go read the book.
If you think that there is a one-off answer, you're incorrect. As David's pointing out, there's a series of things that you can do to start the conversation, to set ground rules, to ask, to check back in, to check back in again. And maybe the answer is that this is a guy that you never were going to really sell a house for anyway. And maybe you would have just figured that out either before you showed him, after 5 houses or 10 or 15. But if this was really the house for him, this is the right thing for him and his family, then you failed in your job by not figuring out what was going on along the way.
I gave you a
shortcut. Right.
I put Cialdini's rule number 2 in the chat for you. Okay. So you can just read the text. Commitment and consistency. Right.
John's situation here, this is something that came up out of the blue at the very end, which is difficult. Right. He never had problems with windows in other houses. And it wasn't that he didn't still like the house. He just wanted a credit for the windows. It's not that he didn't want the house. And then you just have to put it in context of, we have seen all these other 30 houses. The alternative is house B and C that have this wrong with it, that wrong with it, this wrong with it. Is this something, it's a lot more textured. It has to do with their personalities, has to do with your relationship and what you've done up until that point. But that's a difficult situation because it's out of the blue. But it wasn't about the house. It was about he just wanted something. And you've got to figure out how to solve that problem.
Dr. Reese's rule number 2, okay? Before I even sign the paper, this is not a world anymore where if you're the buyer, you try to beat up the seller. And if you're the seller, you try to beat up the buyer. It's a blessing to get a deal done. Okay. I don't do that because I cannot work with that. Okay. So maybe 50% of the time you would have gotten rid of all of that. I got to beat somebody up, right? I need to be in control. You know, when you assess somebody, there's some people who absolutely need to be in control, even if they need to trump up a situation, right? So that they can control it, right? So you cannot make irrationality rational. Okay.
You can also tell him, John, you can explain to him, John, at every point in that negotiation where he got wins, you got this out of this, you got this out of this, you got this out of this. This is something that we're going to have to concede on a little bit, but in the end, you will have this house. You know, this will be yours. It's just a matter of.
You got to get into each. There's a lot of players here. It's not just him. I mean, it's his parents. It's his, who's the behind the scenes. Who else is making influences? What are their motivations? We had one project. We spent a lot of time getting up to the starting line. He must have spent millions of dollars designing the house and getting stuff ready. And it turned out that ultimately, as we figured out afterwards, he didn't want to live in the country with bugs. But he also wanted to stay married. And it's one of those, if I asked other questions along the way under the motivations for the house and what was going on, and again, some of these things you only learn in hindsight, then I could have probably avoided 6 to 8 months worth of our time that got thrown away. So you don't know whether or not, is it the windows? Is it the control? Is it the fact that really he didn't like the house, but his wife did? And this is his way in order to say no without actually saying no. Maybe he wants to move to Florida. I mean, did you research? I mean, so how do you get these questions ahead of time and ask and ask and ask? And what's his pain point? Does he really want to move? Sorry, I used a point that everyone, you know, what would anyone here do to avoid pain? And if it's affordable, you will. And if you as a salesperson can go ahead and find that pain, you can help the person to alleviate their pain and become and get a deal done. If they don't have any pain, I don't know whether or not
You're suggesting I can be more persuasive if I improve my communications more frequently and better communications. I'm going to get a better understanding. And with a better understanding comes a more persuasive. Do they necessarily follow?
If somebody comes in and says, I want to buy a house, do you put that in the win column? No, you're hours and hours of questioning and finding out whether or not this person's serious or not. You got a lot of questions to ask, and then you can, and then the more you know, the more you can figure out. And again, there's a lot of stuff like through Cialdini, a guy Scott Adams, who used to be the Dilbert guy, through Chris Voss, who did a negotiating book under Never Split the Difference. There's a whole lot of this stuff out there that we as humans think that we're unique, and we're not. There's a lot of things we're hardwired for. The fact that we stand on this earth today means that in our past, our ancestors behaved in a certain way which allowed them to survive. And that doesn't mean that everyone doesn't have their own unique little parts and differences, but we have a lot of hard wiring that if you understand and know those things, you can help the person get to a solution that'll benefit them.
Did you just say never split the difference? We're realtors. That's a major part of our vocabulary. We say you're at 800,000, I'm at 700,000. The natural tendency is to say, can we split the difference? Did you just say I can't do that?
It's the default position on everyone. And by never split the difference doesn't mean don't go 70-80 or 80-20 or 70-80, 80-20 or something in that. But splitting the difference in the middle is a almost always just a cop-out, and it's people walking away because you haven't done the pre-work. You haven't done the pre-work necessary to get to a better solution.
But Scott, isn't that the pure compromise? 50-50 splitting the difference? I know there's the book that said, there's a book that's what you're referencing, the book, right? That says never split the difference.
So Roberto, tell you what, you like sweaters. I'll give you my sweater for $1 million. What's it worth to you?
Well, that's reasonable.
Well, we'll split the difference. We'll come down to half a million. It's great. Don't worry about it. This is the perfect deal. So it's only splitting the difference is only rational if you're really getting close. But almost always somebody's way off, you know, somebody's further away from the right answer than otherwise.
Okay, somebody's fair. Losing.
You're dealing with human beings. Rules, rules, rules. In medicine, before you do surgery, there's a concept called informed consent. Right. And when I was doing surgery, that was an exhaustive process. I mean, I went through every conceivable Six Sigma, right, level issue that could have happened in all of those contingencies. So I would not split a difference until I had an assurance that that's the last and final stop of give backs, clawbacks, take backs, credits, et cetera. Okay, you need your one thing. That's your one thing, not like, okay, I got that credit. Oh, and by the way, the porch is a little creaky, right? I need that. And, you know, the driveway's a little bit in need of repair, et cetera. So, but understanding your people from a personality, I don't like to use the word profile, but use the word vibe, if you will. Did you forecast that this person was going to be a nudnik at the end?
All right. So I want to get back to another specific on persuasion. So am I a better persuader if I have better information? If I want 800,000 for the house and you're offering 700 for the house, a lot of the time you'll say, well, show me your comps. And I'll say, well, show me your comps. What did you comp it to? What are you comparing this to? And we both bring our data. And so generally at that stage, somebody shows that they are the greater authority. Well, I've got 50 examples and I've got great arguments and I've got a lot of data to support my point of view. And somebody has less data to support their point of view. Does the guy with more data, the lady with more data, usually win the persuasion argument?
In the quantitative analysis, yes.
Why? Is data that important to persuasion?
Again, put Cialdini's number 5 in the chat box for you. By definition, opinion on its own is less potent than factually supported opinion. So it's a rank order issue. I think it's such and such. Well,
it's a matter of the quality of the data, because I could flood you with data.
Yes.
Yet I could also give you 3 points of data that are the absolute most relevant, and I win.
Mic drop.
Yeah, right? But
right. Well, no, nobody said quantity versus evidently. Evidently. But the point was whether you were having a subjective argument versus a quantitative argument. Because, John, you'd said, if I have more data, and yes, to your point, Roberto, if I have more excellent, vetted, verified, this is it data, are you more persuasive to a rational person who values data? Yes. To an emotional intelligence driven and potentially psychologically driven person who needs to have their emotional agenda serviced, possibly not.
I can imagine if I went to Roberto and I said, that is a good looking apartment. I will give you $1 million for that apartment. And I could see, and I've got 50 good comps I could show you, Roberto, on why that's a good idea. And I can see Roberto, as many sellers say, I don't care what your data says. It's worth more to me. And that's an emotional response. And it's very hard to persuade him with my data because he's already pulled the rug out from under me. He doesn't care that I could provide 50 more pieces of data. So what's going on in that situation?
Again, we're using data as a very broad concept. So if I do a scored use case analysis with 50 different variables, okay, in 5 different subsets of each of those variables, and I come up with a subjective use case score, okay, and one guy's score is that much higher than the other guy's score, I can validate to the higher scored person that he should pay that higher price because he's got a higher self-identified, subjective, but nonetheless, all data is good data value.
What does that mean? I don't understand.
That means that my analysis of the value of something, regardless of what the MLS says, okay, regardless of the last trade for a similar asset on a dollar per square foot basis.
Because that's what I usually do is I show the last 50 trades. So in my business. So go ahead.
Right. The guy who's going to use it better in their estimation, okay, has a higher valuation scoring multiple, if you will, than the guy who is lesser scrutinous about their use case.
But there's a caveat to all of that, because this is about, it's like we have the concept of can you sell anybody on something. So here you win the debate with the data that it has valuation here, there, or the other, but the seller or the buyer might say, I'm just not paying that. So
right.
When it comes to, so we were talking earlier about, you know, can you sell anybody, where can you do, there's a certain point where you have to ask rational questions of the client, whether about buying or about selling, to identify that if they're not answering these things rationally, you then have to quit, because you're like, they're not being rational. They actually don't want to sell or they don't want to buy. So therefore, I'm going to retract my efforts here because this is not getting done.
Or agree that you're going to have a humorous number of weeks dealing in an irrational experience, so you have a story to tell, right?
I don't have time for that.
I mean, we never give up. We always keep trying.
I mean, I'm in pain over your window guy. Right? I'm in pain over your window guy. You lost a lot of time there, right? That's a hard one.
And I think you were right that it wasn't about the windows. It was probably about winning. And it might not have been about winning. It might have been a convenient excuse to not buy.
John, I mean, just asking a question here. What percentage of people consider their home objectively versus emotionally? Especially at the high end.
Yeah, yeah.
10%?
And so a minority look at their home objectively. A majority look at it emotionally. And I think they said that there's a chandelier effect. If I own it, it's worth more than if you own it, then it's worth less. And there's a psychology term for the chandelier effect, or I think it's called the chandelier effect, that things that I own are worth more to me.
There's so much into this that again, what are the emotions? I mean, how much is a house worth when you raised your family there and have all these great memories and you know exactly how awesome it is to have lived there? It's worth more than the guy that's going per square foot. I'm telling you, that's not the right number. And you're not even talking the same discussion. And so
this is all why I believe that this profession is heavily clinical.
I was going to use the word subjective, and like I said, it bothers me that we are so subjective about value.
You're a human being. Why don't you think it's subjective? I mean, people argue, unless you have like the literally in an apartment building, people value apartments differently. I'm involved in affordable housing. We just did a 60-unit apartment building where we moved existing tenants out, built the building, moved the people back in. And I was sure there was going to be fights all over the place as to who gets what apartment. This one's clearly better. That's different. And objectively to me, I could have ranked the apartments. There was not one fight. A lot of people wanted the first floor. Some wanted this elevation, some there. Some couldn't be near the stairs. Some wanted to be in the stairs. Top floor better, middle floor better. And lo and behold, 60 people were all like, no, this all works great for me. I didn't think that was possible. And that was all subjective. And people manage to figure it out.
Wow.
That's rare, though.
Wow.
I thought there'd be fish fights.
Your point is, you know, in the eye of the beholder, right? That whole concept. But that's very rare. You had no issues on 60 circumstances.
But David, what is the definition of clinical? You said the business is clinical.
You're dealing with human beings. You're dealing with all of their shtick. You're dealing derivatively with all the shtick of all their people, right? You're dealing with what you hope is not a codependency situation where you're codependent on them using you as a vendor. You're dealing with their life circumstances, you're dealing with their psychology, et cetera, et cetera. So when you have a clinical engagement, you've got to take all of this into account and nonetheless be resolute in your process and your clinical, quote unquote, recommendations, right? So what I mean by clinical is this is not linear. This is dimensional and straddles between the rationality of data and the irrationality of human beings, which includes their transference, their projections, right? Their needs. So that's what I mean. So John, your window guy, when you gave him your best consultation, okay, and you said, listen, I understand this need of yours, but I, John, in my consultative wisdom, do not feel that it's in your best interest to push on this, that the value of acquiring this asset is much greater than the value of you beating the seller on this issue. What did they say to you?
I want what I want.
Okay.
And I said, are you willing to walk away and lose the house over this? I really do believe the listing agent has backup offers. I really do believe this is the end. This is binary. And he said, yes, I'm willing to lose the house over this. And he did.
Now, John, in the good side of things, though, sometimes people don't believe scarcity because it gets overused a lot and people use it incorrectly. But after he loses the third house because he's been too obstinate, if he really wants to buy, he's buying the fourth one, because then you have a real fear of losing out. But if he loses a second one and he pulls the same trick in a second, I'd be tempted not to have him as a client anymore. Yeah. How can you advise him? And by the way, it's certainly not about whatever objection it is. There's something else going on.
I thought that was a really great summation. Your definition, Dr. David, of clinical, I think summed up so much of what we've said over the last hour, that humans are complicated. There's biases, there's projections, there's a lot more going on. You have to take what I heard you say was we have to take all of that into account. And yet, and I'll let you say it, something about a rigorous process, even though we want to say, it's not knowable. It's too subjective, which is where my despair was coming from. You said, despite all that, there's a rigorous process. Go on.
A rigorous process by which you exhaustively identify variables, okay, and come up with a thesis, a model, an equation, whatever you want to call it, to make the subjective objective.
I love that. It's beautiful.
So when I first started considering making media, I experimented and never released a set of videos called Group Therapy for Realtors. So thank you so much for inviting me into your cadre. And you've motivated me again. Perhaps I will launch Group Therapy for Realtors, to which you are all invited. There is no copay, right? I cannot prescribe for you, but the story that you tell about the window person, I want what I want, is petulant. Okay. It is not collaborative. And that's we're dealing with human beings and we're service agents. Okay. But no vendor ever filled out a request for proposal with a pay for performance scheme where a clause was, I want what I want. Okay. And that's an upfront exclusory variable, right? My name is real estate agent X, and this is my methodology. Okay. And we're going to figure out what you want ahead of time. And it would be a very negative failure, system failure, to come to a result that you turned away a suitable option because you want what you want, right? That's a, in medicine, you'd call it iatrogenic, right? And this is not your fault. Again, you know, I have surgical consideration in these things, but from a preventive perspective, that's a modeling issue, because you and nobody on this call has the time to deal with somebody's psyche way down deep into the process. So does everybody know what Six Sigma is? Everybody on the call?
We think so.
I have at least one head shaking no. Six Sigma is a manufacturing principle not invented by, but popularized by IBM. And the theory is that in order for you to get to the outcome that you seek, you must know every process step, six steps down the line from where you're at. Sigma is the Greek letter in calculus for all or summation. All steps and all potential errors and all workarounds for each of those steps for wherever you are in the process, right? So from a personality inventory perspective, and again, you know, I have a leg up on this, but I want to know, you know, what a client is all about. I don't want to try to figure them out, you know, towards the end game and have a meltdown, you know, because they had issues with their parent, right? That they're acting out at in the process. So,
I love that. We're going to all go Six Sigma as realtors.
That's requisite. That's if a real estate agent is not Six Sigma, they're flying by the seat of their pants.
Oh, I love that. That's your new tagline. I love that.
Well, thank you. So, thank you for helping me. If you visit RE, like real estate, recareerdoctor.com, that's where I'm placing my media. And my goal is to have it be a safe place of elevating conversation. And I chose not to be in real video, but rather to be voiceover in animation for right now, bringing up topics that I think ultimately really matter to careerism and satisfaction in your career. We are, at the end of the day, all together. People's priorities and perceptions of what quality of living means is drastically changing. The nature of urbania, the nature, you know, of material science, the nature of cost of living and retiring and aging, all up for grabs. And anybody who's got an idea should be sharing it with as many people as they possibly can. That's what professionalism is. And we wanted to talk about AI a little bit. So, you know, AI,
we'll do that next time.
Okay, we'll do that next time. But basically, express yourself and your wisdom and your genius in as many manners as you possibly can. And that's not a client-facing thing. That's a peer-facing thing.
So somebody asked in the chat, the real estate, the website name, it's recareerdoctor.com.
Yeah, I'll type it out. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
John,
thank you for a successful episode 75. Thank you, Roberto. Thank you, Dr. David.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And John, if you want to stay on for a bonus thing, I have an idea on the windows.
Okay, you got it. Yeah.